You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we are joined once again in studio by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman.
You keep using that word, Castor. It worries me. It really does.
An expert in the world of...
I didn't know that before.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, a bit of a sting mishap there. but yes, you are, I guess, our expert on Dear Science, at least as people in the studio right now are concerned. Certainly got the most science knowledge here.
Okay, I'll take that. Okay.
Yeah, how's your morning been going?
Interesting.
Yes. That's good to hear for interesting science.
Morning. Yes. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Usually quite interesting. What have we, just to start us off today, what have we got about the environmental impact of green hydrogen?
Well, it's a good question. And, you know, obviously we are at the moment reliant on fossil fuels, and everybody agrees, except for the religious right in the States, that that's got to stop.
Mm.
And so we need alternative energy sources, obviously. And so, you know, we are getting there, I guess. And, you know, there's things like solar and wind and all of those sorts of energies that we can harness in the future at some stage and wean ourselves off our reliance on fossil fuels. And one of the possible alternative fuels out there is hydrogen. And the beauty about hydrogen is that, unlike fossil fuels, when you burn hydrogen, you don't make any nasty greenhouse gas waste products.
Pretty good.
You make water. Now, some people would actually argue that water is itself a greenhouse gas, and there might be some truth to that, but we won't go there in too much detail. But that's the beauty of hydrogen, is it really is a clean energy source. You react it with oxygen, you make water, and you make lots and lots and lots of energy when that happens. Just witness the Hindenburg, those of you who have seen that on
those
YouTube.
Those Hindenburg knowers, yeah.
You know, the airship filled with hydrogen way back when,
yeah,
1930s,
yeah.
Bang, bang, bang.
Okay. Not so great.
So that's the beauty. You don't get any carbon dioxide evolved when you use hydrogen as an energy source. So you're thinking, yeah, well, that's great. Hydrogen's clean.
Sounds perfect.
It does. It absolutely does. There's no sort of waste materials that are going to bugger up the atmosphere. But before you say that it's clean, you've got to look at the way that the hydrogen itself is made. Okay, this is where the problem starts. And so there's all sorts of things that go into making hydrogen. So the easiest way to make hydrogen is to basically take water and stick an electric current through it. Okay, and that's called electrolysis, and that will generate hydrogen and oxygen,
right,
which you can then recombine and get lots and lots of energy. Okay, so where does the energy for that electricity then come from? There lies your problem. So a bunch of workers in both the Netherlands and the UK have looked at this, and they've just published their findings as to essentially sort of the energy cost or the greenhouse gas emissions that you get in making hydrogen, or so-called green hydrogen itself.
Right.
Okay? So yes, when you use hydrogen as a fuel, it's absolutely clean, but it's getting there that causes problems. So, you know, it's wrong to say that hydrogen itself is a clean energy source.
Yeah, it's green when you use it.
Yeah, exactly. It's green when you use it, but in the making of it, you know, that's where you can get CO2 emissions. So what do we need to do to make the electricity to make hydrogen? That's the thing. So obviously we need to use renewable energies. So we need to use things like solar or wind or whatever to generate that electricity, which can then be used to electrolyze water and form hydrogen. So what do we need in that case? If we're going to use solar power, we need to make solar panels.
Yep.
So there's going to be an energy cost in making solar panels. So there's going to be CO2 emissions from that. If we're going to use wind, we've got to make the wind turbines, which are big suckers and everything. So, again, there's going to be a CO2 cost with that. If we're going to store that energy for when we want to use it, we're going to have to make batteries. And, of course, again, there's a CO2 emission that comes from making batteries. So each of these things have got associated greenhouse gas costs, okay? And then you've got to think about, okay, if we're going to make hydrogen and we're going to make it from solar, then we've got to make it in a part of the world where you've got lots of sun. Okay, that stands to reason. So Northern Europe ain't going to cut it, sort of thing. And if that's then the case, then you've got to look at transporting the hydrogen.
Right, exporting all that.
You're going to be looking at making the hydrogen probably somewhere like Namibia or Brazil or, you know, somewhere where you've got lots of sun and infrastructure where you can go and do that. So you've got to transport the hydrogen then, and so there's two ways of doing that. So you can put it in a pipe or you can put it on a boat or a train or something like that. And again, of course, all of those things have got
just
CO2.
Using more energy.
Yeah. And if you're going to put it in a pipe, then you've got to turn it to a liquid. Because it's a lot cheaper to transport, or on a boat indeed, it's a lot cheaper to transport as a liquid than it is as a gas, because it takes up way more room as a gas than it does as a liquid. So there's all of these sort of unanticipated costs, energy costs, that come in generating the so-called green hydrogen. So what these folk found was that, in fact, the best way to make the electricity to make this hydrogen is, in fact, wind turbines.
Right.
Okay, so that's got the smallest CO2 footprint of any of the methods for making electricity, which is an interesting finding in itself, and it's just something to think of when, you know, the next time you hear somebody talking about green hydrogen.
Yeah.
You know, yes, it's green. It's greener than the alternative, shall we say.
Yeah, right.
But it's not completely free of any CO2 emissions. And obviously what we need to do as a race, I guess, you know, as the human race, is to minimize those CO2 emissions. And so, you know, any work that looks at sort of the ecological cost of this energy production is good, you know, and we need to be looking at this sort of stuff seriously and figuring out just what the best way is forward in terms of our future energy requirements.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. And then bit of a silly story here, at least from the headline that I saw. What's going on with these chimpanzees and getting high?
Chimpanzees. I remember on The Simpsons there was a great line when they did their Planet of the Apes takeoff. Something like, "I hate every chimp I see, from chimpan A to chimpanzee."
Classic. Oh, yeah.
Such a good line.
Yeah.
Anyway, chimpanzees. So we would think, as humans, you know, we're the top of the food chain on the planet, and so we're the most intelligent. Blah 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 blah. And so there'd be no other living thing on Earth that would use drugs. Surely not, because we're just the best.
Right, naturally.
And maybe that's not the case. So there's not absolute proof of this, but again, there's a bunch of workers from Europe and Uganda who have been studying the habits of chimpanzees, as you do. And what they were particularly interested in is what happens if you're a sick chimpanzee. I mean, you know,
right.
How do you get better? So I guess you either do or you don't if you're a chimpanzee.
Yeah,
you
know, right.
It's not like you can hop along to the chimpanzee
Doctor.
Hospital.
Harsh life for chimpanzees.
Exactly. So they were particularly interested in chimps that were obviously sick, you know, ill, injured, you know, those sorts of things. What did they do? Did they just sort of hang along with the rest of the people, or do they go off by themselves, or whatever? So what they found from following these chimps, you know, and that sounds like a tough job.
Yeah, right, tracking these guys all around.
Yep. And they found that those that appeared injured or sick would, in fact, go off sort of by themselves, and they would seek out particular plants out in the jungle that they would then eat.
So some sort of isolation and self-care.
Yeah, well, it's particularly the sort of the you know, it seems like some sort of self-medication that they are doing, because what they were looking at particularly was, you know, what types of plants, ferns, whatever, would these chimps go off and find, and did the other chimps eat them as well? And the answer to that seemed to be no, that it was only the sick ones that would go after some particular fern or whatever. Okay, so they were monitoring these chimps, so they were looking at, you know, at any sick ones and anything. Any sick ones, they would then go and pick up their droppings and analyze the urine and all that sort of stuff, you know, just to find out what sort of sick they were, etc. And then there was one chimpanzee in particular that had a damaged hand. And so they took particular interest in that one there because it was obvious that there was something wrong with the hand. And again, that chimp went off by itself, and it went off and found a particular fern, again, that none of the other chimps were interested in.
Yep.
And then what they did, once they found what fern that he was going for, then they went and got a sample of the fern,
yep.
whack it back into the lab. Let's see what's in this fern. Okay,
take a bit of a look.
They do the big old chemical analysis of this. And what they found was, and I guess this isn't unusual because lots of plants have substances in them that can be, you know, helpful medically wise. True. And they found that this particular fern contained anti-inflammatory substances. And, you know, you can sort of draw a conclusion there that, well, you know, it seems that that chimp went for that particular thing because it had this dud hand and everything. And then following it a few days later, the hand had improved significantly. Now, that could have just been, you know, sheer chance.
Yeah,
maybe not. But they did this over a number of chimpanzees, and again, they found that they would go for particular plants. And so, again, they got samples of all of those plants that they went for, and they found that 90% of the plants that they went for had antibacterial substances in them, and 30% of them had anti-inflammatory substances in them. So, you know, these are medicinal plants out there. And, you know, it could be, you know, it's not absolute proof, but it could be that the chimps seem to know this and that, you know, they make a beeline for these particular things when they find themselves a little bit poorly, which is utterly remakable.
Yeah,
I think.
Sounds like they also got a bit of a leg up on us, right? We had to check all these ferns to see if they were medicinal. These chimps already knew.
The rumblings of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Starting.
So I think that that's particularly interesting. And as is always the case in science, more research is necessary.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Maybe these chimps will start their own hospitals at some point. Seems to be moving along that path. And then what have we got about these Nobel laureates.
Okay, so kind of interesting. So, you know, the good old Nobel Prize, it's only been going since 1901.
Only.
And so there's only three science prizes given. So there's the medicine or physiology, there's physics, and there's chemistry. You know. And there can only be a maximum of three people win it in one discipline every year.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
So there's not very many sort of Nobel Prizes in those subjects that have been given out.
Yeah.
And so that sort of set me thinking, well, you know, what's the most popular day that a Nobel Prize winner is born on?
It's today.
On? Well, I haven't done the research, but it just happened to be today that I was going to be on.
Well,
but it seems to me that three is probably quite a few.
Three's a lot. Big number.
To be born on a particular day, the 25th of June. So just a very, very brief bio of them, just to tell you what they did. So the guy, William Stein, who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1972 for studies of the enzyme, a thing called ribonuclease, and that's a little enzyme in your body that chops RNA up into little bits, and it protects you against RNA viruses and things and stuff like that. It does a lot,
right?
a lot more, but we're not going to go into that. A guy called Hans Jensen, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1963, and his big idea was that the nucleus of the atom looked kind of like the atom. So the atom exists in shells. We have shells of electrons. They sort of go out like, you know, shells of an onion sort of thing, you know? And he said, oh, the nucleus of the atom, where all the protons and the neutrons and everything are, similar sort of thing, that they also have a shell-like structure.
Interesting.
And that was proven correct. And then the last one, Walter Nernst. He won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1920, and he was all about entropy. This weird thing, entropy, that everyone's heard of, but nobody really knows what it is.
Classic process. one of those things, you know.
And everybody thinks of entropy, disorder, that's what it is. It's a measure of disorder, but no, it's not. It's not a measure of
breaking
disorder.
Breaking myths about entropy. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a measure of probability.
Yeah.
Is what it is. The probability of a particular arrangement of particles and stuff like that, and how likely that particular arrangement is amongst all the other possible arrangements that you can have. And what he showed, his big thing, was that the entropy of anything got towards zero as the temperature got towards absolute zero, the coldest possible temperature that you can have.
That sounds like it makes sense.
So that was his big thing. And those three scientists were all born on the 25th of June, as was I.
Wow, that's incredible. Happy birthday.
That's my birthday.
No way. And you let us know.
I am entering my seventh decade. It's a big one.
Wow, that's a big birthday. Oh, my gosh. That's, and you're spending your 70th birthday on Dear Science.
70th? Yeah. Not yet.
Oh, right, sorry. I miscounted. I apologize. That's one that you shouldn't make that kind of mistake. I mean, obviously all mistakes in science should be avoided, but that one particularly, you don't want to get there.
Well, there you go. You just made me feel 10 years older. There you go.
No. You should be.
But now you feel 10 years younger.
Yeah, exactly. Right. True. That's the real benefit of the situation. No, I was about to make a joke about another person I know born on the 25th who maybe should be an aspiring Nobel Prize winner now, but then surely.
Oh
you
my
know,
gosh!
Maybe you should.
Maybe you're the next one.
Yeah, maybe you're the next.
I doubt that.
you never know.
And then we can still have you on Dear Science.
That would be incredible.
Celebrity
Nobel
host.
Prize winner, celebrity host. That would be great stuff.
There we go.
Yeah. All right. We're gonna play this thing that was unfortunately played earlier. And then, thank you for coming in this week, Alan. Thank you, Moshat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
Thanks to Moshat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.